supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. 50 years after the Vietnam War, some veterans are still dealing with health effects caused by Agent Orange. WPSU's Emily Reddy reports a law clinic at Penn State is working to get veterans the help they need.
John Gordy from Duncansville remembers getting up close and personal with the herbicide Agent Orange when he was in Vietnam.
All the vegetation was all kind of like wilted and slimy, and I'm there and I'm touching it and smelling it. What is this stuff? And I didn't realize anything what it was. I didn't know anything about Agent Orange or spraying to kill vegetation or anything like that. I just wondered, what the hell was this?
Gordy told this story during a recent StoryCorps interview with WPSU. He became a type 2 diabetic not long after he got back from the Vietnam War. It wasn't until years later that the Department of Veterans Affairs acknowledged a connection between diabetes and Agent Orange. Eventually, Gordy got a 20% disability rating from the VA. His brother Ray had issues after Vietnam, too.
I know when he came home, he had a real bad skin disorder where his back would break out and all these sores and everything.
Gordy says his brother later had ischemic heart disease and oral cancer.
It eventually killed him.
If Gordy or his brother went to the VA now, they would find all their issues on a list of presumptive conditions, which the VA recognizes as associated with Agent Orange exposure.
Chloracne was the very first one. It's a skin condition. That was the very first one that was service-connected. There's diabetes.
Michelle Vollmer is the director of the Penn State Law Veterans and Service Members Legal Clinic, formed in 2015.
Parkinson's disease, peripheral neuropathy when it has an early onset, prostate cancer, some respiratory.
Vollmer says veterans whose diseases are on the list can often just go to the VA and get a disability rating. The problem comes when it's not a presumptive condition and they need to appeal their case.
But anytime they want to connect something that's not presumptive, it's going to be the same approach: medical research, case law research, medical experts.
Many veterans can't afford that. Vollmer and the students who work in Penn State's Veterans Legal Clinic do the medical and case law research for free, and they've found some medical experts willing to donate their time as well. The clinic's first case was a Vietnam veteran and former Penn State professor with acute myeloid leukemia, or AML. It's a cancer that often develops later in life and that is not on the list.
For him, it was really about the service connection and the recognition that Agent Orange was horrible and should never have been used in the way that it was used. That's what it was for him. It wasn't about the money at all.
Vollmer and her students had to prove the connection between AML and Agent Orange and get him as high a disability rating as possible. All those steps take time.
So it would have been roughly 9 months in total, but spanning 2 years before we had a final result for the client because of the VA system.
They eventually got him a 100% disability rating. They hope to eventually get AML added to the VA's list of diseases caused by Agent Orange. In between these few major cases, the clinic has done dozens more, including educational benefits appeals for current Penn State student veterans and pension cases for World War II and Korean conflict veterans. It was two law students who came up with the idea for the law clinic. One of them was Justin Bish, who was also a fairly new officer in the Pennsylvania Army National Guard at the time.
I started seeing issues that my soldiers were personally facing with the VA after coming back from deployments, and I wanted to make a difference and try to improve their lives while also teaching those who weren't involved in the military some of the issues that I was seeing my soldiers face.
Bish worked on that original Agent Orange case. He was already graduated and working as a lawyer in State College when it was finally finished. But he says Vollmer emailed that they had won.
I was very proud of the work we've done, and I was very emotional. And you couldn't have asked for a better experience and a better client. After decades of people telling him your illness wasn't from your service, we finally got it for him. And so it was a surreal experience.
Bish says he'd like to see the administrative process for dealing with these cases improved. Appeals to the boards of veterans for different states can yield different results for cases with very similar details. And each case doesn't create precedent for the next one.
We had this with one of our experts we talked to. They said, hey, I already wrote an expert opinion on the very same thing for this other veteran on the same location. I already did this. Why do I have to do it again? Can't they just grant the benefit? And now we had to go through the process again, which is why it takes so long.
Bish is one of only a handful of lawyers in Center County who specializes in veterans law. He says he hopes the Penn State Veterans Legal Clinic will encourage more students to focus on veterans legal issues. In State College, I'm Emily Reddy.
Advocates of better care for older adults with dementia are gathered at a two-day symposium in Malvern through tomorrow. Joining me is Dr. Alan Power, newly named Schlegel Chair in Aging and Dementia Innovation at the Schlegel University Waterloo Research Institute for Aging in Ontario, Canada, and Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Rochester, New York. Also, author of Dementia Beyond Drugs, Changing the Culture of Care. Al, thanks for being here on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. Great to be here.
The numbers are beyond dispute. The number of Americans older than 85 is expected to double between the years 2013 and 2040. And with that, obviously, the number of Americans with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. Your work pretty much upends the prevailing wisdom on dementia in general.
It does. And maybe just to put a little sense in the numbers, actually, the numbers are increasing mainly because the baby boomers are aging. Actually, recent research shows that succeeding generations have a lower lifetime risk of dementia. But it's just because there are 10,000 Americans turning 65 every day. And because it's so much an age-related condition that we're going to see this big bump over the next several years.
So we're looking for better care. But you contend that better care breaks down in the prevailing medical model to date. Explain. You're a doctor.
That's right. Well, there's no doubt that there is disease in the brains of people with dementia. There are probably 100 different causes of this syndrome we call dementia. But we have come to view it so narrowly through the biomedical framework that we've stopped seeing the person who's living with dementia, stopped understanding their perspective, their experience. And in doing so, we've actually caused a lot of fallout for people. In particular, what got me into the advocacy field is the way we overuse certain medications like antipsychotic drugs instead of understanding how better to support people.
Apparently, some 30% of those who were institutionalized receive antipsychotic drugs?
It was about 24% of everyone in nursing homes in 2011 who was not using it for schizophrenia or another approved condition. That has come down to 15.5%, but that's people with and without dementia. And if you look at where we are today and just look at people in long-term care who have dementia, we're still talking probably about close to 1 in 4 people, about 25%.
You're contending that most of the alleged benefits of these types of medications are based on studies done by the pharmacological companies?
Actually, pretty much all of them. I did a research of all the studies I could find when I first started writing this book 10 years ago. Since I wrote the book, a lot of studies have come out that show that these drugs are much more dangerous and much less effective than they were purported to be.
You also take aim at the institutional model.
Well, that is where I started. I was working in a large nursing home in Rochester, and I was working in this culture change world, which is what the group I'm speaking with, Pennsylvania Voice, is doing, which is basically changing institutional culture, trying to create living environments that are much more conducive to what the individual person's needs, wants, and desires are. But what I have found and what I express in my second book is that the use of these drugs inappropriately is actually much higher in the community. We give a lot of attention to nursing homes because we have the data. We can track their use. We can't track their use outside of nursing homes. But the few studies we have suggest that there are probably many more people at risk on these medications in their own homes than there are actually in nursing homes.
Who can you look to, either in the United States or beyond, as examples of entities that are doing it right or doing it significantly better?
There are individuals and groups around, but one of the people that I've worked a lot with recently that I like to point to is Alzheimer's Western Australia, because they really have an expansive view of dementia, and they are providing more than just support. They are actually doing things like starting a project where people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's in the community are hooked up with a volunteer opportunity. So instead of being told you're dying, you're fading away, they're actually being told you have a purpose. We want to keep you engaged in your community.
Where does Pennsylvania rank among states?
Well, if we look at antipsychotics, they're right in the middle. They rank 27th out of 50 states plus District of Columbia as far as their antipsychotic use. They dropped it from just below the average in 2011 to now just below the average now at 15.4% of all people in long-term care. We don't have a lot of data about people that live outside of long-term care. The only thing I'm really going on is a large government study that looked at 1 million Medicare beneficiaries in the community who had dementia, and 14% of them were taking antipsychotics. So if you extrapolate that to the population, knowing that many more people with dementia live outside of nursing homes, not inside, that's where I get the idea that there are many more people at home that are at risk. But we don't have numbers like that for any state because the drugs are not approved for dementia. So other than nursing homes that are regulated, there's no way of tracking this.
Dr. Power, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
That was Dr. Alan Power, newly named Schlegel Chair in Aging and Dementia Innovation at the Schlegel University Waterloo Research Institute for Aging in Ontario, Canada, and Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Rochester, New York. This is NewsWorks Tonight. All across Philadelphia this past weekend, high school football teams vied for city championships across many divisions. One matchup stood out, though. The 5A Public League title game featured a little slice of local sports history. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron explains.
About 7 years ago, John Davidson, an assistant principal with the Mastery Charter School Network, asked his bosses if they'd consider starting a football program.
A lot of our young men were leaving at high school. They were going to different schools for sports.
If Mastery had its own team, Davidson argued, they could retain some of those kids. Not long after, he heard back from Network CEO Scott Gordon.
I got a call February 11th, 2011, and said it's a go.
When now coach Davidson retold that story Saturday, his Mastery North Pumas were about to play for the 5A Public League Championship.
Play hard, play smart, play safe, have some fun, play some football.
Standing between the Pumas and that coveted crown were the Simon Gratz Bulldogs from North Philadelphia. The same year Davidson convinced Mastery to start a new football program, the Charter Network took over Simon Gratz, a troubled public high school in North Philadelphia.
I mean, nobody wanted to go to Gratz because it was like, it's scary.
Vonsel Harrigan graduated from Gratz in 2003. Since then, the football program has gone from bottom of the barrel to perennial contender. Harrigan says that success has changed the way people look at the school.
It brings everybody together instead of having everybody saying, let's go out of the neighborhood to go to school. Instead, everybody want to go to Gratz now.
The game between Gratz and Mastery North marked the first time two schools in the same charter network competed for a city football championship. That points to Mastery's rapid growth. It's the largest charter network in Philly. And it also points to Mastery's growing embrace of sports as a way to keep kids engaged and enrolled. Fittingly, it was a tight contest. A late charge from the underdog Pumas made it close, but Simon Gratz held on for its third straight title. It was a three-peat for the Bulldogs and a first for charter schools in Philly. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
Many look forward to getting a fresh haircut, but for those who cannot afford food or a place to live, well, that's a luxury. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, a new barber in Philadelphia's Olney section is trying to change that, thanks to a stranger's goodwill.
Phenomenon Perfection Hair Studio is buzzing, literally and figuratively, when Robert Hall takes a seat in a barber chair by the front door. It's the first day the new shop is open, and it's also the first day of free haircuts for a group who rarely get the pleasure, the homeless. Hall smiles as the sides and back of his balding scalp are clipped close to his head.
It makes me feel good about myself.
Hall, who speaks with a stutter, says getting a haircut makes him feel more independent.
More confident, just about myself, you know, feel like a man, you know?
That's exactly why owner Brennan Jones says he started giving free haircuts to homeless people.
We notice them, but we don't give them enough love. We don't show them enough respect as people. We just look at them and we keep on going. We pass by them all the time and we don't acknowledge that they are even there.
Earlier this year, a homeless man asked Jones for money on the street. Jones handed over a couple of bucks and a banana, but he says guilt began to wash over him as he walked away. Not long afterwards, he hauled his clippers and scissors to Center City and started giving haircuts to homeless people on the street. The goodwill caught the attention of fellow barber Sean Johnson, who just so happened to have a storefront space he wasn't using. After striking up a friendship with Brennan, Johnson recently handed him the keys to the empty shop so he could continue his work indoors. The story went viral. No surprise to Johnson.
When you wake up out of the bed in the morning, the first thing we do before we walk out the door is look in the mirror and look at ourselves. A haircut can start off a great day, a bad haircut can end the day.
Brennan says he hopes the new barbershop can change people's perceptions of homeless people.
I'm hoping that people see me as this beacon of light. If they can't personally identify with it, they just, you know, just flash back to if it was them and decide to get involved. The more hands on deck, the more we could do. The more people that we were able to bless, the better the world will be.
Michael Dahl is executive director of Broad Street Ministry, an organization that provides a variety of homeless services. He says there's a very practical benefit to giving homeless people a haircut.
People are often trying to find their way back to stability, and so they're going in and interviewing and trying to get a job. And so looking presentable is just another way of helping them along that path back to stability.
Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Conditions look increasingly intriguing for the possibility of life in our solar system beyond Earth. Let's take a trip to Saturn with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, actually not the parent planet, but one of Saturn's moons.
There seems to be a lot of liquid water out there. We're talking about distances away from our sun up to 885 million miles plus out. And we're also beginning to understand a mechanism through which that water can remain liquid because of a heat source.
Well, if that heat source is not the sun, tell us more.
And that's the really interesting question about this. When we look at the moons, the first thing we surmise is that tidal action, tidal forces caused by the moon's motion around the gigantic planets, being pulled back and forth between the gigantic planet itself and the other moons of that planetary system, it was thought that perhaps this was a way to generate heat for these interiors. But upon further analysis, at least with one of these moons of Saturn called Enceladus, perhaps that's not enough motion to cause enough heat generation on a solid cored moon to generate the heat necessary to keep water at a liquid at that tremendous distance from the sun. I mean, if you look at the system overall, what you see is that these outer planets, Jupiter, for example, generates more energy than it receives from the sun. So can that energy be transferred somehow to these moons? And this gravitational motion that causes the tidal forces that might keep the interiors warm might be one. But on a solid cored object, that might not be the case. If the core of that moon is not solid at all, but is made up of some other form, either pieces or more sandy, in which that tidal friction caused by the pull of the bigger planet and the other moons might allow these inner materials to slide past each other, generating friction, but then because of the unconsolidation, be porous enough to let water from the surrounding liquid ocean penetrate so it can be heated. That might be a way for enough heat to be generated to create the water jets that the Cassini spacecraft saw spewing out from the south pole of Enceladus.
Is it beyond dispute that there is a liquid ocean?
It is well beyond dispute that there is a liquid ocean. There's a considerable amount of water there. And the models that are being examined don't show any reason why this mechanism would not have been in operation for perhaps a billion years or more. Studies and models indicate that microorganisms showed up on this planet within 500 million years. That's half a billion years. So given that perhaps Enceladus at its core might have been generating heat with a liquid water ocean for perhaps a billion years. That's twice as long as it seems to have taken for microorganisms to develop here on Earth. One of the ways that we've identified the possible development of microorganisms here was in the deep oceans, down on the ocean floors, where hydrothermal vents circulated that hot water and through the rock layers in the upper mantle and lower crustal regions of this planet allowed for the solution of minerals into this water that is then brought back into the ocean environment where it could be used by microorganisms to sustain their life. There's no reason to imagine that the development of hydrothermal vents on the floors of the oceans at Enceladus could not have happened also.
Let's park for the moment this search for life on other orbs and take up a very strange phenomena, a supernova that just won't quit.
Stars can reach a point in their life where they can no longer sustain the energy generation at their core. The core collapses, the temperature rises dramatically, the outer envelope of gases is blown off in an effort to rebalance itself. We know this big explosion as supernova. It seems to be a one-and-done kind of event. However, what we're seeing is now an object that appears to have multiple stages of supernova activity, where it blows off some of its envelope, but not enough to change the core dramatically enough so that it completely breaks down and starts on its next course. But instead, we've seen this star peak in its brightness and energy, drop off as if it's gone supernova, and then rise up to a peak again and again and again. And nothing like this has been seen before. There are some possible suggestions for after 3 years of observation, it may be that the star is finally beginning to tail off in its energy generation and assuming its next stages of life.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.